Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Having a safe, stable home is critical for more than just protection from the elements. Stable housing helps people live healthier, happier lives with less risk of injury, illness, and trauma that our unhoused neighbors face on a daily basis. In the past decade, increased attention to the growing numbers of homeless people has resulted in multiple efforts to help get people off the streets with mixed results. The United Way, the Municipality of Anchorage, and other partners started the Home for Good pilot program in 2019 and are beginning to see results. We'll hear about the ideas behind the program and how success is being measured today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. What does it take to help someone who has chronic struggles with housing find a path to stability? What changes when a person is no longer bouncing from shelter to shelter or sleeping on the ground and can focus on taking care of themselves? There's a lot of evidence about the cost to communities in emergency services and capacity for people who are vulnerable to homelessness. Helping someone have safety, access to health care, and employment helps all of us have a more thriving community. Many programs have come and gone that have attempted to crack the enormous problem of affordable housing and helping low-income families. So what really does work? Here to describe the Home for Good program and the successes that are coming from it are some of the municipal and business leaders who put it together. Eric Utrecht-Billingsley is the president and CEO of the United Way of Anchorage. Thea Agnew-Bemben is a special assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance. And Brian McCutcheon is the vice president of the Behavioral Services Outpatient Division for South Central Foundation. Thanks all of you for being here. It's great to have you all in the studio with me.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Statistics point to rising numbers of unhoused people. Anchorage Daily News reporting from last January found unsheltered homelessness skyrocketing in recent years. Between January 2019 to January 2024, there was a more than 250% jump in numbers. Excuse me. The number of people staying in Anchorage emergency shelters rose nearly 40% from the point-in-time count in January 2019 to January 2024. And right now, it's really cold in Anchorage, a dangerous time to be sleeping outdoors. So before we dive into the details of the Home for Good program, give us an overview of the current situation for unhoused people. How many beds are available versus the number of folks in need in Anchorage right now? Who wants to tackle that?
I can start us off with that.
That would be great. Thank you.
Great. So one of the mayor's main priorities is that we have fewer people sleeping outside. I think you just did a really good job of describing the increase in unsheltered homelessness that we've experienced here in Anchorage and in Alaska and then across our whole country. If we look from 2020 to today, in the point in time count in 2020, January, we had about 100 people counted as unsheltered. And in each of the last 3 years, we've had 400 people. So that's just here in Anchorage. So one of the mayor's main priorities is to have fewer people sleeping outside. And one of the ways that we've implemented, starting really in about October this year, with partnership from the Assembly, is to move from having more of a seasonal shelter system to a year-round system. Because what we found is that when you kind of ramp up shelter during the winter and then shut a lot of it down in the summer, people become accustomed to going indoors and then coming outside and camping. And it really is hard to provide that type of quality service that helps people really become stable, move into housing, get connected with treatment and other services, get reconnected with family, or their home communities if they're not, you know, from here or wanting to go back to where they came from. So starting in October, we now have 300 beds that are year-round. So we have two locations where we have 100 congregate beds and then a third location where we have 100 non-congregate beds. And that's year-round. And in those two congregate locations, we can add surge capacity. So between, you know, about November and just actually we just added some beds on Friday with some emergency assistance from the assembly. We've added 50 additional beds in each of those congregate locations. And then on Friday, we added another 25. And we needed an emergency authorization to do that because we can do that really in times of, for example, when there's very cold temperatures like we were seeing. We're also really maximizing the use of our Anchorage Safety Center. So that's our first responder drop-off location. And in years past, it's had a pretty high bar for entering into the safety center. We've now kind of lowered that bar so that if a police officer or our mobile crisis team or an EMS unit or a safety patrol comes upon somebody and they're not incapacitated, but they would like to go with them, they can now take folks in. So what we've been seeing there is we're getting to kind of around 30, 35 people there on our cold nights. And that's great because what we're able to do, that's available 24/7. Our low barrier municipally operated shelters are also 24/7. So what we're able to do is kind of move people straight from safety center into a safety bed, or sorry, into a shelter bed. And sometimes if someone goes to shelter and there isn't a bed there, they can go to the safety center. So we're really like on a hourly basis, our shelter providers are connected to each other. They're doing that type of coordination to make sure that as people are coming, you know, to the safety center or coming to shelter, that we're able to fill every available bed. And we're also really coordinating with the other community shelters, many of whom are funded by the municipality, and some of them are not funded, but they're still partners, and making sure we're also really maximizing those beds as well. So we're seeing, I think, good results from that. We also have made it a priority to address camping in Anchorage. That's also been a big priority of the mayor's. So right now, in contrast to probably any time in the last 5 years, we don't have any big camps. We do have, of course, some people still sleeping outside. We're doing very coordinated and kind of relentless outreach to people who are outside to ensure that they know that when they're ready, they can come indoors. If they want to get into detox or treatment, we can get them in immediately. We have behavioral health partners, South Central Foundation, as well as others that are accompanying us in that process. We also have the Third Avenue Resource and Navigation Center, which is available to people, Beans Cafe. So many of our traditional partners, we're all working as closely together as possible to make sure that we're giving people the opportunity to come inside when they're ready.
Thank you for starting us off, Thea. And just a follow-up here, the point in time count, as we know, is just a point in time. So it's a one count, one night. Do you have an idea of how much of an undercount that represents and what the overall need is in the city compared to how many available beds there are?
I mean, I think what's really important to understand about counting people who we consider unsheltered is that that isn't a static number. So oftentimes people who are using emergency shelter, using the safety center, they're coming in and out. So we have very good counts of who's using shelter in a month, a year, you know, a quarter. We have very good counts of who's using the safety center. We know from camp reports, and like, for example, I just got the weekly data distribution on camp reporting. Like this week, it's very low. We have very few reports from the community on camps right now. And it's been going down steadily since July. That's partly because we have actually abated a lot of camps. And that is part of our outreach effort to, again, kind of help people move indoors, help them get connected to resources, connected to home. And so the point in time count is valuable because it's the same method every year. So it's kind of our one stable metric that we can really look year to year and see how we're doing. So my big goal is that when we do that count next month, we're going to see a drop in unsheltered homelessness. That's like my guiding light right now, is that we really are addressing people's needs and helping move them indoors.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about helping vulnerable Alaskans through a program called Home for Good. My guests today are Eric Utrecht Billingsley, who is the president and CEO of the United Way of Anchorage. Thea Agnew Bemben is a special assistant to Mayor Suzanne LaFrance of Anchorage. And Brian McCutcheon is vice president of the Behavioral Services Outpatient Division for South Central Foundation. Eric, give us kind of the backdrop of what the Home for Good program is and how it works.
Thanks. So the Home for Good program started at United Way. We incubated it and continue to oversee the program with partners such as the municipality and South Central Foundation. This program and the participants in the program are those that have been chronically or homeless for a number of years, typically more than 3 years. In addition to that, they have the participants have utilized emergency services throughout the while they've been unhoused. The way we identified the participants or what made them eligible for the program was a number of factors. First is looking at the HMS database for shelter stays. In addition to that, looking at EMS transportation, and then finally arrest records as well. And so we identified those as the target population for this program that have been needing assistance. And these are people that want to be secure, want to have housing, and they want to get better. And to do that, they've had trouble finding housing and then stable housing for that. And the way this program works is not only do we provide housing or access to housing, but also provide intensive case management through a partner with South Central Foundation. And they do it through two ways. The intensive case management, if you think about it, is both for their health, both mental and physical health, healthcare appointments, and then even transportation to some of these appointments as well. The other piece of this is what's called wraparound support services. So if you think about it, this is helping folks with their medication regimen, the ensuring that they have access to all their federal benefits that they're entitled to. And it really helps these individuals become stably housed through this whole the process and those that have been long-term unhoused. What we found with this program is that it has worked. We have some really good information for it. And we've had a number of partners throughout the life of this program.
And when you're looking at this part of the population that you're focused on and helping, what do you want other Alaskans to know about who they are? Because as we know, there's a lot of times misinformation and perceptions about who is without housing. And there's an assumption that it's people who are addicted. And that's not always or necessarily even the majority of times. We know that people struggle for a lot of reasons, and we're seeing more and more of that based on the price of housing and health care situations that people are struggling with. What are you seeing?
So this program was targeted to those that have been utilizing those emergency services and had been unhoused for a number of years specifically, right? And so there's a number of programs that are across the continuum of care, both the immediate rapid rehousing to transitional housing. This is on the spectrum of the permanent supportive housing. So those that have had struggles, disabilities, whether unable to hold jobs or get jobs for various reasons, and to your point, whether it's physical or mental health needs, and this is where that intensive case management was really, really important to help these individuals. So it's not just enough to give them the housing, but also to provide that intensive case management to really help them on the journey so that way they can continue to be stably housed through the whole life of the program.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Brian, South Central is a partner in this Home for Good effort. Tell us about the services South Central provides through the intensive case management.
Well, I think the easiest way to frame the work done through intensive case management is its connection to all resources available within the community. So that's the biggest piece of it. It's a conduit through which you can access the rest of your community, whether that's primary care, as Eric talked about, behavioral health services, substance use services when appropriate or identified as a opportunity for the individual, social security disability, public benefits that people qualify for, But it goes beyond that. It's connection to community and culture as well. One of the things that Thea talked about early on was how we've transitioned at the municipality from a seasonal to something that's sort of year-round. And I think that's really important. And that's one of the key anchors of South Central's approach to case management is the consistency mm-hmm. and a longitudinal relationship and a longitudinal experience. So we've worked with the identified participant, customer owners in South Central Foundation language to identify what's important to them. We haven't touched on this specifically yet, but it's a housing first initiative, right? So we lead with housing, an opportunity for safe, secure housing. I think it's pretty clear what the immediate benefits are. If you have to store medications, if you have personal safety concerns, if you're experiencing trauma, so getting a reprieve from the things that can happen to all of us and the ability to do some things that we really take for granted is the hook, right? That's a real benefit. That's a value for any individual in the community. And then we use that as an anchor to build treatment plans. So we start by introducing the housing as an opportunity, and then the housing becomes the anchor for the treatment planning that's identified by the participant in the program. So what are the things you'd like to work on to help maintain housing? What are the obstacles you're trying to overcome or things that are present for you as you're navigating housing? I've given this example a few times. I hope it makes sense to folks. Lots of folks have done an Airbnb, right? And when you look on the Airbnb profile, there's different rules for different houses, different quiet times, number of guests. Those are all things that all of us navigate every day. And when you're moving from a community and when you're navigating homelessness, Thea talked about the camps, they are in fact communities, right?
Yeah,
there's a way of being, there's a way of navigating, there's expectations of your participation in that community. And we move someone to housing, that landlord's got different expectations. And it creates some really interesting opportunities in terms of treatment planning for the individuals participating in the program. How do you have a healthy relationship with your landlord? How do you advocate for yourself? This is a population that's, to Eric's point, we're working with some of the folks who've been unhoused for the longest and maybe, I think it's not inappropriate to say marginalized by the rest of the community. So folks aren't used to advocating for themselves. So how do you do that in a healthy way? How do you have a good relationship with a landlord? How do you have good relationships with your neighbors? How do you incorporate your friend groups into this new opportunity that you've built in other communities and other settings? How do you have a healthy way of bringing those folks along with you in your life? And how do you identify, I think the biggest part is identifying what you need and what's in service of your goals. So that's the primary focus of intensive case management. And it could run a wide spectrum. You touched a little bit on substance use and sort of this idea that all folks navigating homelessness have substance use issues. I think it's one thing to say you need to stop using substances. I think it's a completely different approach to say, what are your long-term goals? And how does the use of substances or the way you interact with individuals in the community impact your ability to maintain those things that you want to achieve? It's just a more gentle and human way of entering in the conversation. And that's the focus of intensive case management.
I'm so fascinated by that. And I want us to drill down a little bit into some of those areas going forward. But the overall idea of giving people some sort of autonomy over themselves to maybe for the first time in their lives, if they have come from abusive situations where they didn't have any control or were given the respect of making decisions for themselves that led them down a path of instability, to be able to have that, I could see the benefit in helping people have that choice available to them. Mm-hmm. I was a peer counselor in a safe house many years ago, and that was a lot of what we did with people that would come into shelters. They would say, well, I know you're a good person. You tell me what I should do. And we would say, well, no, the good news is you get to make your own decisions for your life, and you can decide. Here's your options, and you get to take that power for yourself, maybe for the first time ever. So I can see where that would work, and I want to talk more about that. But Thea, I want to get back to you now. Your connection to the Home for Good program goes back a lot further than your work in the mayor's office over the past year or so. You worked on the feasibility study for this about 5 years ago. Tell us what you found that made this program stand out from others, because as we know, there's so many different efforts underway.
Yeah, so prior to coming to the mayor's office last September, for a long time before that, I had my own firm, Magnubeck, with all the great colleagues I had there. And I think it was actually 2018, we worked on a feasibility study for what was called the Pay for Success project. And really the philosophy there, and it comes from other places around the country as well as in other countries, and it makes a lot of intuitive sense to people, is that we should be paying for programs that work. So, and that the payment for them should be tied to the outcome. And so that really is how Home for Good was set up. In the feasibility study, we went through some of the same metrics that the evaluation of Home for Good is now reporting on. So, for example, the things that Eric mentioned earlier around what is the cost to the municipality or the state for certain types of services. And one of the things you find when you go through that is that's sort of a trickiness about this approach is that different entities pay more for different parts of our system. So, for example, if you go to the emergency room frequently, say you don't have any insurance, well, guess what? That hospital is kind of paying for that service. And there's some federal money that tries to help make that up, but that's kind of coming out of their pocket. If you have Medicaid, it's coming out of the state's pocket and the federal government. If you're using EMS frequently, that's really a municipal service. So one of the trickiness in figuring out how to do this type of program is sort of figuring out which payers you're able to engage and kind of show the benefit of. And so in this case, because we're working in Anchorage with the municipality most directly, so the state has a benefit from this, but they're not necessarily part of this project. We really focused on the ones that were costing the municipality money. So at that time, we looked at shelter, we looked at emergency services. Those were kind of the main things. And what was kind of interesting when we did the cost comparison, because we also were looking at some similar housing programs that existed then, some of which still exist, like, for example, Carlick Manor, which is also permanent supportive housing. We were able to look at some of their cost data, you know, how much does it cost for them to keep a person in a unit for a year? And what was kind of interesting with the feasibility study, and you do find this, I think, a lot with this type of project, is that when you start out, you think, oh, we're going to see this great reduction in costs. But really what it is spending like pretty much the same amount of money, but spending it for a better outcome. So you can either spend, I think, if I'm remembering rightly, at the time of the feasibility study, it was like $45,000 a year. You can spend that for somebody to churn through jail, shelter, EMS rides, or you could spend that amount of money for them to be safely housed and receiving the types of services that Eric and Brian described. And that's kind of what the feasibility assessment showed, is that it's not a great decrease in cost, but you get a much better outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And also that ripple effect throughout the community.
Exactly.
Of better outcomes.
Yes.
That yeah. benefit all of us.
And
of
actually,
course.
That's a really good point, is that to the extent that somebody's calling EMS 9 times a day, that means that same EMS rig is not able as quickly to respond to other calls. So the opportunity cost is a huge part of it.
Help us understand, though, who is putting the money up, and then where the payments are going. How does that work, the payment for success? I'm trying to figure out.
Sure. So there's a couple criteria for the pay-for-success model. Well, let me back up. So over the life of this program so far, we've secured about $11.6 million from various sources. It's a braided funding strategy. We had a lot of philanthropy raising initially. We've received various government grants, both federal and then also the Pay for Success contract with the municipality as well. And has really helped this effort. So what that goes to is really for the housing component of it. And so we are able to pay for housing for those individuals in the program. And then South Central is able to pull in the federal resources to help pay for that intensive case management overall. So our goal with that is to ensure that people are stably housed through the program. Regarding the pay for success model, where we see those payments are on a couple factors. So first, it's on stably housing those individuals. So that first month, then we could receive a payment. And then after the 6 month mark, if they were stably housed through the 2 to 3 month mark, we received a payment. And then it caps out about 24 months per individual. Now, in addition to that, like I said, we have the federal funding that we've secured for other to continue this program and ensure that we have enough resources to support those individuals throughout the life of the program.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're discussing helping vulnerable Alaskans through the Home for Good program. We're going to take a break here in just a couple of minutes, but Brian, I want to back up to that idea of people having that autonomy to make decisions for themselves. It seems like it could be difficult for people who are suffering from past trauma or substance misuse issues. So how can you help coach people about what would be beneficial for them and have them have that clarity to be able to make those decisions?
Wow. There's a lot in that question. So maybe I'll, there's a number that's sticking in my head, a statistic, and I think it's important to share it. Again, folks could be forgiven in the larger community for assuming that folks are looking for something without doing the work. Because it's a Housing First project, we have over 98% of our participants, when I last checked, were actively participating in behavioral health programming, right? So it's an option, but over 98% of folks elected to do the work.
That's extraordinary.
It's a pretty impressive number, given it's an option. So how do we build momentum around that? And I think that's through longitudinal relationships. So for the first, Eric talked a little bit about us securing federal funding. So we're able to offer this intensive case management program through Medicaid billing. The vast majority of folks qualify for Medicaid at the time they enter this program. Some people grow out of that through vocation and other things. But the first 90 days is really about relationship building. So last time I checked the numbers, it takes about 90 days to get someone under a treatment plan, which is sort of a defined pathway for that Medicaid billing. Those first 90 days are all about relationship and demonstrating value. I think you did a nice job talking about various starts in this community, areas of focus that have gone on over the years, very well intended. And the downside of some of those is that they're federally funded. So when the grant stops, those things stop. And we were very intentional with this project, and United Way continues to be extremely intentional about the people who are receiving services and not ending those at the cost of maybe bringing on other folks. So it's all about the longitudinal relationship and building momentum, offering value. And I think your description of supporting someone at a shelter is the first step in that. This is what's important to you, and I can support you in accomplishing that. So that's how we break the ice, and we take a lot of time, invest a lot of energy in consistently showing up for folks, being available, and finding them where they happen to be in the community, but staying with it in a way that they might not have experienced in other parts of their life in a very healthy and intentional way. And I might not have answered your question, Lori, so.
Well, you know, in past iterations of programs, there was oftentimes a mandate that you have to be sober before you can get into this program. And that approach has changed, clearly. Housing without sobriety mandates, what has research found in terms of that? Is it seen as just too condescending and taking people's autonomy and choice away by saying, you have to do this, this, and this before you get to this next thing?
So I don't have a clinical background, and it would be inappropriate for me to speculate on what the research indicates. But I would say at a human level, I think we all respond better to a conversation that's about what is that you hope to achieve, what would you like to accomplish, and what modifications might we need to work on to make that happen. I don't know that any of us would respond well to someone coming into our house on Thanksgiving or Christmas, right? And telling us that the conversation will go better if we don't use alcohol. And many families struggle with that around the holiday time. I think it's a different situation to say, what is the experience you'd like around this family gathering, around this this relationship with your landlord, this relationship with your community, and to the degree possible, let's impact the areas that are of concern for you. So that might mean using less substances. It might mean using substances in a more safe and intentional way, a reduction. So it just feels like a different conversation on a human level.
All right. We are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about helping vulnerable Alaskans through the Home for Good program as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing helping our vulnerable neighbors through the Home for Good program that's been piloted and is working in Anchorage right now. And we'll find out about possibly expanding the program to other places and what the possibilities could be in that respect. In the studio with me today is Eric Utrecht Billingsley. Eric is the president and CEO of the United Way of Anchorage. Thea Agnew-Bemben is a special assistant to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance. And Brian McCutcheon is the Vice President of Behavioral Services Outpatient Division for South Central Foundation. Thea, you wanted to add something in. We were just talking before the break about helping people, but not mandating you have to start from a certain place, just meeting them where they are and what the research shows about those two different types of approaches.
Yeah. I think it's a really important question. So here in Alaska, starting in around 2020, I think is when it was approved, we basically, the technical term is an 1115 waiver. It's a federal process that a state can go through to, in our case, we did it for behavioral health treatment services. And essentially what it does is allows the state to kind of test new approaches to something that Medicaid's paying for. And as long as it doesn't increase the cost for the federal government, it's allowed as a demonstration period. So we're now in our second five-year demonstration period for this set of services. But the service that Brian was describing, intensive case management, is one of those services that didn't used to be a billable service and is today. And it's part of a kind of change in approach that really emphasizes peers as an important part of the treatment workforce, because that is where you can start having that very genuine relationship from the outset. So, for example, here in Anchorage, with our outreach teams, we have behavioral health providers who are peers who actually accompany our outreach teams and who are present at Third Avenue Navigation and who will come to meet people in shelter or meet people in a camp. And they start that process right at that moment to say, hey, you know, I've been where you are and look where I am today. Like, you can get into recovery. Like, this is possible for you. So I think that's one part of it, is a real change in our system that emphasizes that. And another very important change is that we now have different types of medication that can really help somebody's success in recovery. So, for example, we are still in the grips of an opioid crisis here in Anchorage and in Alaska. And for people who have an opioid use disorder, you can access medication. So right now at the municipality, we're figuring out ways that we can provide that medication even sort of right after someone experiences an overdose, and then help them bridge to a provider that could provide that on a longer term basis. There's also, people might have heard of the physician and clinic in Danilchik who are doing mobile services, where they're using a medication called Sublocade, which actually lasts for a month. So part of what you're doing there is really helping ease the physical symptoms of addiction so that somebody can have the mental clarity to be able to have the kind of conversation and discussion that Brian was talking about. Those medications also exist for people who have an addiction to alcohol. So part of what we're really trying to do is kind of blend those new treatment options so that people can make that kind of easy entry into treatment and recovery. Our micro-unit project that we just did a ribbon cutting for last week also will be operated as a treatment program using all of those same modalities.
So the peer, it kind of reminds me of some elements of AA, where peers are helping each other and finding sobriety and helping people see a different path forward by someone who knows, rather than an official coming to talk to you about, here's what you could be doing. Eric, you said one of the goals is to help people find housing stability until they get vouchers. Talk about why this is a challenge and how the program helps in the voucher realm.
Sure. So let's start with one of the challenges right now. The challenge is that on average, it takes about 6+ years for an individual to get a voucher through the program or program participants. Now, that's an average, right? So some individuals are able to achieve that or get those quicker. Others aren't. And there's a number of factors. The big factor, the biggest issue that we see on that is the federal funding. The federal funding model is based off population, poverty rates. I think there's some housing stock issues. And so as an example, which I think has been brought up before in the community, is Houston, Texas at one point had a very similar population, point in time counts. you know, they receive 10 to 15 times as much funding as the Anchorage community receives. And so if you think about it, right, so we have a that as a, one of the barriers and challenges. And so Brian mentioned earlier, one of the things that we've been very mindful about in this program is to ensuring that these folks do not have a setback in the access to affordable or to housing through the program. And so we stopped accepting new participants in March of last year because we wanted to ensure that we had enough funds for them through the life of this until hopefully they can get vouchers or other sources to pay for their housing. And so that's been the big focus of this program, is the recognition of that it's not a they cannot afford necessarily a momentary blip. We all have challenges and setbacks, right? Yeah. We are humans, and the impacts that our families and communities will have on us. And so our goal is to really help through all of that. And so this is where that totality, and as Brian mentioned, that the longitudinal thought process is for, is really important. But that voucher situation is definitely a challenge for all of the community, not just the Home for Good participants.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Ty, I believe it's Ty, is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello, thank you. You brought it up spontaneous-like, so it kind of dovetails here. Used to, meaning several months, a year or two ago, more about Narcan's role in rescuing folks and being very important. I know, for instance, some folks who go out, distribute clothing and other things to the homeless, and I'm not aware any of them are very aware of the Narcan. And I'm assuming it's still important, and maybe being able to make folks aware of it and help them get Narcan, though I think it's probably pretty expensive. But, I mean, some perspective would be helpful is my question.
All right. Thanks for the question, Ty. And I would say, just based on my own experience, yes, carry Narcan. I carry it all the time in my vehicle. I'm on the trails a lot and take it with me, and have been able to help people, and was grateful that I was there in that moment and could offer assistance. Thea, you wanted to pick it up.
Yeah. There. So we have data that our fire department tracks of when the public administers Narcan, because obviously we're only able to count it when the public has administered Narcan, and then our EMS rig is also comes to the encounter. But what we've seen over time is that that has increased greatly. So the public is using Narcan. They are doing what you're doing, Lori. Thank you. And it is life-saving. Narcan is available through the health department, the Anchorage Health Department. We actually have locations all around the community where we keep what's called harm reduction supplies stocked. So we have community partners that distribute that. And I don't have those locations like right in my memory bank right now, but we can share that through our website. But
things.
Yeah, so having the availability of Narcan is very important, and I think people are using it. And then I guess what we're focused on right now is what happens after that, because what we see is that's a real opportunity for somebody to potentially make a change.
Absolutely. Yeah, please pick it up there, Brian. I know that when I was able to help someone, and when the ambulance came, took this young man away, and I was so glad that he was alive. And someone said, well, but you know, why help when they'll just go down again next week? And I said, well, hope springs eternal for me that this person will wake up in the hospital and say, yikes, I need to change my life. I could have died. People do that every single day. We know it works.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One, the other thing Thea started out with was a lot of coordination around when we catch folks seeking shelter and how we build momentum, right? If we can't stay at the in shelter, we stay at the safety center, right? So there's that coordination to not lose someone when we get them. I think that same conversation overlaps really well on this conversation around Narcan. It's critical, it's important, but to Thea's point, when someone's in that hospital, they wake up and you engage them in a conversation, ask about how this is interfering, what they'd like to accomplish in their life, and offer an alternative. So Sublocade's a really good example, because that medication can stay on board for a period of time and you don't have to store it, you don't have to lose it, no one's going to take it, right? That's really important for a subset of the population, but this is why stable housing is so important. When we talk about some of the other medications, just simply a place to secure your medication. And I'm keep being stuck in this interview even about the theme of coordination and building momentum. So we administer the Narcan. We have an opportunity for a conversation and intervention in a setting, offer people an alternative, and then don't let them go. Keep engaging as we do that. So several, South Central Foundation is one of them. Other agencies in town are also doing it, which we can introduce Suboxone or Sublocade immediately. We're moving away from this idea that you need to show up perfect and ready to participate, yeah. and shifting to a concept that was it that you'd like to accomplish, and let's see what we can do between now and the next time we meet, and let's build some momentum, and hopefully those periods of time get longer. Eric talked a little bit about relapse. We have relapses in life, whether related to substance use, relationships with family, friends, coworkers, right? Recovery from life, I think, is a nice way to frame it. We're all going to have little setbacks, but maintaining the consistency of having a resource to go to, and then to follow Thea again, the availability of 1115 made this sustainable from a provider standpoint to administer these services. So that's a big part of the longitudinal relationship.
Mm-hmm. And that idea of showing up perfect, none of us do. None of us show up perfectly. And having some humility around that and realizing that all of us at some point in our lives are going to bump along and are going to need the help of others. So keeping that front and center, I think, is really important for all of us. Let's go back to the phones for a moment before we take another break. Janae is in Thorne Bay. Hello.
Hi. Had three rentals over in Ketchikan. The COVID money rolled out. The top apartment didn't qualify for it because they were all three working. Two apartments did. One apartment, the year when the COVID money ran out, and believe me, the COVID money pay was a lot more than what we were charging for rent. The COVID money pay was like $400 to $600 a month more than our rental was. But if you take this person, we'll pay you this money, right? At the end of the year, one apartment went to jail, lost all their kids to foster care. The second apartment, the tenant burned down. So my conclusion is, if you want to house people on the economy, you need to provide a lot of support for people, because these are people who, at the end of the year, when they had that year free rent, they didn't pay their rent. They, you know, we had to like give them eviction notice to make them wake up and pay their rent. And then they went to other nonprofits to get the money to pay the rent. But the secondary fallout is that's why rent is so expensive now for other people, because after the COVID money ran out, nobody lowered their rental prices. But we did for the people who were working. We said, okay, we'll take $600 a month less rent because you stayed when everybody else pretty much failed.
Okay. Well, thank you, Janae, for that. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and see if our guests want to respond to your comments. Thanks for staying with us as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We just had a caller who talked about complications with support that came during the COVID-19 pandemic, federal and state support to help with housing and other things, and her frustrations with how some of that ended up. And Eric, you had thoughts. Please help us out here.
So what I would, a couple points I'd offer up is, first is the access to intensive case management is very, very important for this program. I mean, it was the part of the foundations for what we're looking to do, recognizing that these individuals and the participants in the program need that support to continue their journey to be stable in the housing that they're provided, or you know, earning, frankly, even as they, you know, get vocations and jobs and contribute to their income. Additionally, as far as like landlord support, is we make funds available in case there are situations where there's damages to apartments and such, so that way we want to be a good neighbor for those landlords as well. And then the other piece I'd add in here, and this is where we've talked about pay for success, but we really haven't touched on it, is there is an evaluation that's done on a frequent basis for the program, and that's actually the genesis for when we created the billings to send to the municipality to show the outcomes of this. And what that meant as a touch point is when somebody entered enters the program and after 12 months, as one frame of reference, is what we've seen as a number of reductions. What it is 83% reductions in the number of shelter stays, 76% reductions in the number of safety center intakes, 63% reduction in the number of arrests, and 32% reduction in the number of EMS transports. So those are real numbers, yes. Real outcomes, and we're seeing the benefit of those. And those participants in the program are really seeing the benefits of those. And so I think what you need to think, what you can think about is, it is that case management and that relationship-based approach that South Central really drives home and brings to those individuals, that stability of having the housing, and then allow these participants to move along the journey to get the secure housing, whether it's through vouchers or other sources of income that allow them to pay for their apartment.
And you talked a little about the evaluation. You have a third party that looks at what's happening and evaluates that. Who are you working with to do that evaluation, and what are they measuring? What you mentioned, some of the reductions in calls for emergency services. Is that part of what they're looking at? Are there other things that they're also evaluating?
So the name of the evaluator is escaping me at the moment. However, they've been a wonderful partner through all of this. What's being measured is what the stats that I just provided to you. And so we're continuously and constantly looking through how do we measure the success of this program. And the other piece I would add in is the number of individuals that are still stably housed through the program. And so there's the reduction on the critical services or the emergency services, but also, again, the contract with the municipality, the payments only came when those folks were stably housed. And so that's the criteria that we're looking at. To Thea mentioned earlier, we want to ensure that we see the outcomes. And so that was the change in the pivot of this pay for success model, was we were only paid during when people were stably housed. When they were stably housed, what we saw was that reduction of those critical services, and they got access to intense case management.
Yeah, Brian.
Lori, the other thing I heard in the phone call with the caller was a ton of opportunity, right? Looking through the lens of how could we have intervened differently, to Eric's point, with intensive case management. How do we set up that family so it's not a flurry of activity when a funding stream stops? How do we, to the degree possible, help people engage in employment if appropriate? How do we get more of a longitudinal stabilized benefit so we're not popping around from nonprofit to nonprofit mm-hmm. in a period of crisis? That's a big part of what intensive case management does. So it's maximizing people's ability to participate in the community, to advocate for themselves, to support themselves. And there's just a ton of opportunity in her phone call, both in the concrete losses to the landlord and in that family, right? And their role in the community and the way they get to engage in the community. There's a lot of room for intensive case management and building a glide path for folks out of this situation. And again, it ties back with what Thea said around introducing the right medications or the right interventions when you have an opportunity to engage with someone to break this cycle of sort of eviction, look for another landlord, and that becomes self-perpetuating. And that's a big part of what United Way's done with its funding, is built longitudinal relationships with landlords. So it's not a revolving door of eviction due to frustration. With releases of information that are signed by the participant in the program, we can have active conversations with the landlords. We can help develop new ways of communication and help people reach a shared understanding, which helps us be a longer lasting experience as we move towards independence.
Yeah, it makes sense having all that support around you and clarifying those relationships. If I'm understanding it correctly, there's 104 people in the program currently, 87 housed, 17 waiting. Where are the 17 that are waiting? Are they still outdoors, or are they in a shelter setting, or where are they?
It's a little bit of a mix. So there are some that are still outdoors, unfortunately, some that are in shelters. The challenge can be is finding those available units, as I think we know and hear those, the available housing stock or apartments are difficult to come by. There's an ongoing effort to continue to find these resources and provide those resources to those individuals. But it's a bit of a mixed approach that unfortunately those 17 individuals are facing right now.
Mm-hmm. Thea, you mentioned the municipality may include support for this program again in future budgets. Will that money come from grants, or how would it be funded?
Yeah, so the municipality's budget cycle, I think, as maybe folks know, although I know this is statewide, but here in Anchorage, that's an annual process. So The timeline for it is really in October. The mayor makes a budget, submits that to the assembly. There's a period of hearings and amendments, and then that gets passed in November. And then that's our budget for the next year. So it's really a 1 year, you know, we do that process every year. So with the funding that was originally contracted with United Way, you know, as Eric mentioned, they're not accepting new folks in right now, but some of that is still active in the program through 2026, or at least part of 2026. And so, and again, a lot of the funding for this project came from philanthropic sources, federal grants. And so as United Way kind of pulls that together and thinks about what their goals are for the next phase, then, you know, next year would be the time when we could talk about that and see what the mayor might want to put forward for 2027.
And for all of you, we only have a few minutes left here. What do you envision for the future of this program and addressing this really big need that we have in the community for helping people find stability? And as I mentioned earlier, that helps all of us. The more people are stable and healthy and doing well, the better outcomes all people in a community have. What's your vision for the next 5 years to a decade, Eric?
So the next 5 years is we're really hoping to find a phase two of the program or the funding for it. It will take the very same approach as finding Brady funding sources. Thea described it well. It'll be a mix of philanthropic grants and ideally some type of contract or multi-year agreement with some type of government agency to help provide some of that stability for this. We know there's a need for the program. What I would think about it, or maybe a way to frame it is, it's not a question of does this work, because we've seen this works. We have the outcome, we have the data, we have a rich data set to show the outcomes of this program. It's, will we be, as a community, willing to invest in the next 100, you know, individuals for the next 5 years? And that's a goal for all of it, right? Meaning, like, if we're able to secure $9 million, then we can help another 100 individuals. Whether it's all at once or we look at a multi-year braided type of approach, we're in that effort now to begin. You know, the what I would share with the public is we're looking to do this, and there's, you know, from if you're a philanthropic funder, you know, please, we're happy to continue the conversations. You know, the Rasmussen in the past, the Mental Health Trust, you know, Community Foundation, others. You know, we saw a really well-sourced initial philanthropy fundraising, and we will continue that journey and conversations. You know, for the general public, it's advocating for what solutions are working and where do you feel they need to be time and effort put into it. And so that's going to be our effort. We're at the five-year mark. We're optimistic that we will find the next funding sources and continue this program because we see the need. And again, we have the information that shows that this does work. It's not a question of that. It's that information that we have, and we're very confident that we can be able to help more people out.
And Thea, from the municipality's perspective, your thoughts on this, and how are you working beyond things like Talk of Alaska, working to get the word out to the public so that they understand that this is a program that is effective and is having success? Because we know there's a lot of exhaustion mm-hmm. in the public. There's so many things coming at people from every direction every day that everyone's pretty stressed out, and it's hard to have compassion and empathy for some folks right now. So how are you messaging the successes here, and what do you see in the future?
Yeah, maybe I would just start by saying I'm not exhausted, and I think there's actually a group of people in our community, and I'm hoping that we grow that. I think the mayor is really leading that's excited about where we can go, that we can solve these problems if we work together. So at the core of Home for Good is the combination of safe and stable housing, and then appropriate levels of supports. And we've made a lot of changes at the municipality to enable different housing types. Our micro units is like a baby version of that, but I think there's a lot of other possibilities, from ADUs to tiny homes to mobile homes. So what we're hoping to do is really just expand that level of housing stock and then have the connections with our behavioral health providers to layer in those services as needed. Mm-hmm. And I think if we do that, we can all be a part of it and we can scale that up as quickly and as effectively as we have the will to do it.
Just a few seconds.
I think covered well by Eric and Thea. I think maintaining momentum for something that's demonstrating results and maintaining this high level of coordination. Yeah, it's much needed.
All right. Thank you all so much for the work you're doing on behalf of all of us here in the community. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.